Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us for our podcast again this week. Each week, we interview a leader and they share lessons learned in their career. And this week, we're happy to have with us Rick Brimacombe. Rick is an advisor to executives and companies. He's been an investor, worked as a VC, and he has some great lessons that he's going to share with us today, thoughts that can help you in your career, and looking forward to our conversation with Rick. Rick, it's great to have you join us. And first off, can you give us just a little bit of your career background, a little bit of your story?
Yeah, thanks, Mark, for having me. I greatly appreciate it and look forward to our conversation today. In thinking about kind of my story, I think it would miss the point if I didn't go to where I started in school, because I took 3 years of science and math classes thinking I wanted to go to med school or dental school. And then I decided not to do that. And I crammed 3 years of business classes into 2 years. So it took me 5 years to finish school. With that said, I basically took 6 years of college and learned a lot, both in the science and math side, as well as the business side. So all the folks out there who are unsure of their trajectory or things they maybe started and then shifted gears and went into a different lane, just wanted to tell everybody out there that that is definitely okay, and you need to listen to your inner voice and pursue what you think makes most sense for you. When I was taking the business classes, I got a job working for two stockbrokers, and it was kind of a combination, research gopher / analyst for them. They had me dig stuff up and do work, and this was pre-internet days, so it meant running down to the library and gathering stuff up and getting things mailed to us and doing a lot of number crunching without having the benefit of the internet. Anyway, taught me a lot about investment, the investment world. And what I decided to do from there was to go into investment research, because the analysis side of the equation was what was of interest to me. So I did investment research for a couple of years and basically learned how to analyze companies and help folks make buy or sell decisions on stocks. That led me to investment banking. Again, there was an analysis component, but there was also a transactional component, like raising money, selling companies, doing venture capital deals. And that part was interesting to me. So I did that for a couple of years, and that introduced me to a deeper understanding of the venture capital world, which allowed me to kind of combine both disciplines. And then also work more on the company side. So kind of 1 foot in a company and 1 foot outside a company. And so I started doing venture capital, and I've done a couple of different flavors of that over the years. Kind of like the ice cream shop that has a bunch of different flavors. I've done a couple of different twists on the venture capital industry over the years. And one of those stops was Sherpa Partners, a seed fund I did with a couple of other guys. And I did that prior to starting my own firm back in 2005. And so the core skill sets that I learned was analyzing companies, raising money, how the capital markets work, structuring things for the capital markets to invest in, and then again, combining it all and doing venture capital.
Great. I always ask this same question of every leader that we have on is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give a 22-year-old Rick?
Well, good question. And I think we all can reflect on our career, especially after we've had a little time in them. I think, you know, looking back, and if I had an opportunity to talk to my 22-year-old self, I probably would have encouraged me to take more risks. I pursued things that I found interesting, and I pursued things which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit more later, things that intrigued me. But I think maybe there were some things I could have taken a few more risks on. I think I also probably could have been a little bit more open to new ideas, a little bit more flexible, adaptable, because I think that's critical. And then probably, and not that this meant Now looking back, not that it, that I did it wrong, but I think it would have been, good to have the clarity. You not only do a job in your career, but you work for someone. So I would say be very focused on who you work for, the kind of person you work for, and the kind of organization you work for, and not just what you're going to learn or how much money you're going to make. And so picking your bosses and picking a phase of your life and what you're going to learn from that phase as a step in the journey as a big important part, as opposed to just, you know, what's your paycheck going to be or what's the name of the firm on the, you know, the billboard or whatever.
Is there kind of on the flip side of that, is there any advice that you received when you were around that age that looking back you should have ignored or did ignore?
I think that not so much specific, hey, here's a piece of advice that you have to follow, but society has tracks and they try to steer people to a track, get on that track, stay on that track. And so I guess just the kind of societal norms of doing something in a conventional manner. I think that that would be something to maybe not fully ignore, but acknowledge that you're being steered in a certain way. Just because you did job XYZ doesn't mean the next thing you have to do is ABC. You can move sideways, you can move diagonally, whatever. And then I think society has a way of trying to get people to stay or color within the lines. And so I think being more open-minded. And so for me, looking back, I went into investment research and could have stayed there, but I figured out I didn't really like to write that much. Mm-hmm. And back then, investment research was a lot of writing. Still is a lot of writing, but even more so back then. And so I liked the investment industry, so I stayed there, but I decided I didn't want to do that. So I moved over to investment banking. The raising the money and structuring of deals was great. With that said, and the transactional nature where there's a start and a stop to a project, that also is great. With that said, I learned that I prefer to have ongoing relationships with my business clients. And so to start a project, stop a project, and have no future interaction with them or go years before you interact with them again, I didn't like that. I wanted things that were longer in duration and the relationships and such. And so that led me to venture capital. And so rather than getting on one track, I was in the investment community, but I moved diagonally a couple of times. And so you don't have to stay on the same track that society creates for you or what a particular industry creates for you. You can take what you've done, lever that, and you know, hop to the next lily pad.
So in your world, working as a venture capitalist, an advisor, board member, what mistakes do you see young leaders making as far as, and I think some of those mistakes you probably have seen repeated over and over again, but anything stand out that someone that's a new leader should avoid?
Are you talking about their own kind of personal journey or how they incorporate other people onto their teams or
where? Yeah, it could be around that. Is they're taking over a leadership position within a company. What are some of the things that you see that are pretty common for somebody that's moving into that new leadership role?
So anytime you do something new, there's going to be some challenges. There's going to be, and it's normal, human nature, a little bit of self-doubt, a little bit of concern over certain skills that you may be missing. And so first thing I would do is, okay, what things do you have doubts about and what skills do you think you need to improve and where might you get those? It may be inside your company, it may be outside your company, but I would seek folks and or things that you can do to improve on those, whether it's listening to podcasts like yours, or whether it's reading books, or whether it's going to seminars, or what have you, or maybe it's finding a new mentor because you're at a new level and the mentor that was serving you for the first part of your career journey, not that that person needs to be replaced, but you may want to supplement that person. And this mentor may not come from inside the company. You may have to go outside to achieve that and learn that stuff. As far as the hiring and the building the team, it's very easy, again, human nature, to hire kind of yes people. And I'd encourage folks to try to build their team with people who are going to speak their mind and lay out the case for what they believe, and people that will be strong enough to defend themselves in their position. So you don't want to build your team just with yes people. There's also a bunch of tools out there, and I'm sure you do a lot of them, Mark, with your profession on the executive recruitment side, is how to try to find people with the right fit. Some of the, kind of low-hanging fruit for folks, the Strength Finder, and trying to understand how they might supplement the team. And you don't want everybody on your team with the same strengths, right? You want to build your team with individuals that do different things and have better skills in areas that you don't, and others on your team. There's one, I don't know if you've ever used the Enneagram, Enneagram. Again, it's a way to assess personalities, and you want to have like a sports team. You want to have individuals with different skill sets. And so trying to build your team not to look just the same. And that's not a physical thing. It's more of a mindset and a capability standpoint. And then everybody's got a story. Everybody has a personal motivation, and trying to understand the drivers for people, because it will be easier to work with them as well as motivate them if you understand what those folks want. Not a perfect analogy, but if you look, there's a book about relationships and the five love languages. Everybody gets their props in different ways. Some people want to have the verbal props. Some people want recognition, like a plaque on the wall. Other people, money's a bigger driver. So there's all kinds of things that motivate people. Lastly, trust your gut in the sense that people might be telling you, oh, Jane Doe is great, or John Smith is wonderful. And if your gut is telling you something different, there's something to that. So trust your own gut, your own instinct. And then I guess last but not least, people give you references, and I'd encourage folks to go outside the standard core of references, try to do blind references so that you're hearing from people outside of this, curated list of folks that they want you to talk to. So try to build a broad team, not just yes people, trust your gut, and kind of do your own homework on assessing folks.
So you mentioned mentors as a part of your, and I'm sure you've had mentors in your career, people that were early on in your career, as well as I'm sure advisors that you've bounced things off over the years. Talk a little bit more about that as far as the importance for you.
So in hindsight, and you'd asked about advice that I give my 22-year-old self, talked about the importance of bosses and mentors. The way it played out, I was really lucky. I did not consciously search out bosses like I think I would now, or I would tell all the folks here on the podcast, or I'm telling my own children. I have two out of college, recently out of college in the last couple of years, and two in college. And we've talked about stuff like this, but whether they're your boss or your mentor, a particular job, especially early in your career, is just a part of the journey. And the paycheck you get, and again, the name of the firm on the wall, certainly are important, but compared to what you're going to learn and what you're going to gather from the experience, way less important. And a gentleman I interacted with a number of years back talked about, in your 20s, you're just trying to learn. And in your 30s, you're trying to get positioned. And in your 40s and 50s and beyond, you're out trying to execute on all these wonderful things that you've learned and such. So if you your career as a journey and you say, hey, what can I learn right now? What can I gather up in my own skill set such that I'm more valuable in the future and maybe I can leap further to the next lily pad, as I mentioned earlier. And the people that you're going to get that from are going to be your mentors and your bosses. And again, the mentor does not have to be inside your company. I think people miss that boat a lot. Go on LinkedIn and find the person that you find amazing for whatever reason and think to yourself, hey, I'd like to be at that person's position in X number of years, and reach out to them. Especially here in the Midwest, folks are going to be open to trying to help other people in their journey, I think maybe compared to other parts of the country. And so reach out to those people who are doing things that you strive to achieve and do. And there was a gentleman here in town that a number of years ago, I actually said to him, I said, hey, I want to be just like you when I grow up, and spent some time with him over the years learning from him and have emulated a little bit of his career with stuff I've done. So the mentors are very important. The bosses are very important and should not be either minimized or not included as you're kind of looking at your journey. It should be right there next to the attributes of the company and your paycheck and what you're learning. And then, oh, by the way, here's your column for all your mentors, and having those people be a big part of what you're doing.
Okay. Now, you've been on the other side of the desk, hearing a lot of pitches over the years from people that are entrepreneurs, that are leaders within companies that they've started or maybe have joined and are needing to raise some money. What advice would you give someone who is in that position that is looking to raise some capital?
Well, first thing I would say is ask why. Some people, back to, you know, conventional wisdom and what society tells you, say, oh, you have to raise some money. Well, maybe you do, maybe you don't. Lots of times, companies are not ready to raise money and they're going to just be wasting their time because they haven't created enough traction. They haven't done enough on their own. So the first thing I would say is get as far as you can on your own nickel and your own time. And it doesn't mean you necessarily have to quit your job. You could do nights and weekends for 3 years working on a project. You can build a technology team and come up with a minimal viable product just doing sweat equity and issuing a little bit of the equity pie. So that would be the first thing. Second thing would be, all right, so now you want to go out and talk to people. What are you going to show them and what are you going to tell them? The story is critically important. Two ways to package up your deal that I tell people all the time would be Guy Kawasaki's 10, 20, 30 format, which you can find in Art of the Start. And then Slidebean is an organization that spruces up PowerPoint presentations. And there's a lot of web stuff out on Slidebean and Airbnb. And Slidebean shows you what they did with the original Airbnb PowerPoint. And so using those two as templates, if you do 90% of what you see there, you're going to be golden. So you need to have the right materials. Then you have to reach out to the appropriate person. If you have a SaaS product, it does you no good to reach out to somebody who invests in med device technology. So you got to target the right investor. And then I think it's very unrealistic to expect stuff to happen quickly. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And every once in a while you read an article or hear something online, hey, the first person I called invested. But the reality is you're going to have to reach out to 100 people to get 5 folks that are interested, or even 10. And of those 5 or 10 are interested, only 1 or 2 of those are going to be real candidates to invest, or at a time in their business journey that they can invest, whether they're busy with other projects, whether they don't have the cash flow, whether they don't have liquidity, whatever, what have you. And so it's a process. It takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. And so I guess then the last thing would be start early, which is if you want to raise money for your company, who might you call on and start to build that list and maybe build relationships with those people so you don't have to do it starting from, you know, scratch when the time comes. So you can build relationships with people, follow them, see what they're talking about. And so that would be something. And then I guess maybe the last piece, when you reach out to folks, especially professional investors, if there's something you can do to add value to their world, whether it's knowledge about one of their portfolio companies or whether it's something that you read that would be of interest to them, if you can try to add value to their world, it's going to help you a lot and give you a better chance on developing a relationship with them.
That's good. You mentioned a couple books already, that Guy Kawasaki's book and Love Languages. Any other books that you think would be good for a leader to have on their shelf?
Yeah, the Love Languages. Yeah, for those of you out there who called to talk to us today about your marital relationships. No, Mark, that's not our goal for today. On the business front, I don't know if you saw that Clayton Christensen passed away last week. If you haven't read any of Clayton Christensen's books, I think he's amazing. Almost a Bible for the world that I'm in, the technology world and things where technology is impacting or influencing. The Innovator's Dilemma is an amazing book. I think two main things I took away from that is shifts the utilization curve up. And so to not just look for incremental improvements, like at the grocery store, new version of whatever soap detergent you use to wash your clothes, and it says 5% better, 10% brighter, you know, whatever. Clayton gives you a lot of examples of changing the utilization curve, changing the rules of the game, and talks about how industries can be disruptive. So from that standpoint, those are two great lessons from The Innovator's Dilemma and one of my favorite books. Also on the business front, Monk and the Riddle, Randy Commissar. Kind of the takeaway there is follow the things that you have passion for and focus on your purpose, applying your time to what's most meaningful to you and not just chasing a dollar. We talked about that a little bit earlier here today. And then one of the analogies he uses that has been helpful to me is, especially I'm sure would be helpful to you in the recruiting business, is different companies need different management teams at different points in time. And in the Monk and the Riddle talks about different breeds of dogs, and on the front end, how you need a retriever or a pointer to point you in the right direction, or go get the pieces of a puzzle and assemble a puzzle. And then you need a bloodhound to kind of sniff out the trail and bring those pieces of a puzzle down a trail. And maybe you even need a St. Bernard to pull you out of the snow when you're stuck and you need to be saved. And then last but not least, once you have it all figured out, you need a husky, a sled dog at the front of the sled to just pull it fast and hard and to operate. And so one of the things that Monk and the Riddle taught me is different management teams or different boards at different points in time. And then to kind of wrap it up into a bow, talking about the journey being the reward. And it's not just, oh, I want to make a bunch of money, or, oh, I want to accomplish these things. The journey, the process is the reward. And so Monk and the Riddle is the favorite. And last but not least, going off the typical business script, but the Four Agreements is an amazing book, The Four Agreements. Just real quickly, be impeccable with your word, because you can never take those things back after you say something that you may regret. Number two, don't take things personally. Lots of times stuff that happens is about them, not you. Number three, don't make an assumption. And then four, just do your best in the process. And so times that my feathers have gotten ruffled, or times that I felt personally kind of off track, I go back to the Four Agreements and kind of step myself through those things. Lots of times I can extract my thinking from a particular situation and stay more balanced and more open-minded to what the solution might be, and or try to understand what's happening, as opposed to taking things personally, saying something that I may regret, making an assumption that is faulty and not exploring that, or beating myself up for not doing better. And so the four agreements has been very valuable to me personally.
It's good. A lot of good stuff. He gave us a great reading list to fill at least part of our year with. So that's great. Talk a little bit about kind of outside of work. You've got other interests. What do you do to recharge?
Sure. Well, I'm a family guy. I mentioned my four amazing adult children. I'm very blessed to have them. I have a wonderful relationship with my father. So doing stuff with my kids now, they're going different directions with college and other stuff. So having everybody together is fun. We get to spend time together up north in the summer. That's amazing. Individually, like doing things outside. I believe nature is a good balance to the stuff that we do in the work world, especially when we're in our head, on the phone, on our laptops, whatever, doing spreadsheets, PowerPoints. So being outside, exercise, I really like a lot. Started doing yoga about 12 years ago, and that's been wonderful to me. And for folks that want to blend kind of a physical activity with something that also is very cleansing from an intellectual perspective, yoga has been real good. And so those would be how I would fill my time if I had a completely free day.
Okay. So talk a little bit about some of the things that you're involved with, and how could somebody, if they were interested in learning more about some of the things that you're doing, how would they learn that?
Sure. So I have three different pieces to the puzzle. If you think the top end of the funnel is Club E, that's clube.com, www.clube.com. It's a content and networking platform with a bunch of events. We have multiple locations, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Maple Grove, and semi-regularly up in Duluth. That's one thing that I do and allows me to interact with a broad base of people and bring relevant content, curated content to those folks. So that's one. And then my advisory practice is brimacomb.com. That's the last name, brimacomb.com. That's my advisory practice. And then my investment vehicle is brimacombcapital.com. And so if you think of a funnel, I have Clubby at the top, then I have my advisory practice, Brimacomb and Associates, and then Brimacomb Capital, the investment vehicle, at the bottom. And so those are the easiest places to find me and learn about what I'm up to. Obviously LinkedIn too, but.
Great. Any parting advice that you'd give someone?
You know, given that we're trying to target emerging leaders and folks moving up in their career, maybe at kind of earlier stages in what they're doing, I'd encourage folks to think that it's their life. It's their journey. They get to do it their way. They don't, as I said earlier, have to just follow conventional wisdom or what other people are saying. Hey, after you do A, you do B. Well, not necessarily. Similarly, don't just chase the money. It's kind of easy to say, well, this job pays more. Yeah, but what's that boss look like, and what are you going to learn? And so I'd encourage you, especially early in your career, to put the money actually aside and look at more, who are you working for? What are you learning, and what's that going to do for positioning you for the future? Again, targeting the bosses you want to work for. It's a little harder early in one's career, but as I've gotten a little older, I have the no a-hole rule. I know we're trying to be a family-friendly production here today. So there are people that you do not want to work with or for. And I think I probably earlier in my career could have weeded some of those folks out a little faster. Now I can shut it off before I'm, you know, halfway to first base. So be aware of who you're working with, negative energy, negative attitudes, people who are just going to create roadblocks, hurdles, speed bumps, whatever. Those people aren't constructive. And so picking the people who you work with to the extent that you can, it's going to be valuable. And it's a great, wonderful journey. And sometimes it's easy to get bogged down into the little nuances of a day-to-day thing, but keep your eye on the prize, keep your eye on the horizon. And if you're doing the things that we've talked about here today, you're going to be aiming in the right direction, and all will end well. There just may be a few challenges along the way, but don't get bogged down there.
Great. Well, thanks, Rick. This has been very helpful. I know our audience appreciates the insights you've shared today, and wish you continued success in all the things you're doing.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here, and thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.